This interview is brought to you by Cambridge University Press. Please visit Cambridge at www.cambridge.org. There you can find their entire catalog of books. And, of course, you can buy them there as well. So please visit the press today. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books. And this week, I'm very pleased to say that we have Marcy Hamilton on the show, and we'll be talking about her book, God Versus the Gavel, The Perils of Extreme Religious Liberty. This is the second edition of this book. The first edition was published in 2005, and it has been released again for reasons that I think Marcy and I will discuss. The topic is very well, topical, I guess is what you'd say right now. Again, we'll talk about this. But let me begin by saying, Marcy, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Could you kick us off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I am a law professor at Cardozo School of Law, which is part of Yeshiva University in New York. Before that, I clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. And I am the only expert that I know of who specializes in religious groups that break the law, and came to this through a circuitous and serendipitous route. But the short story is I had a case at the Supreme Court. All the religious groups ended up being on the other side, and all of the groups that suffer and fight with religious groups for civil rights and children and women ended up being my allies. So here I am today.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's calling. Sorry, I guess that's...
It is, in fact, calling, oddly enough.
Yeah. You can do God's work wherever you are, as a professor of mine used to say. All right. Well, could you... tell us why in 2005 and then why reissue God Versus the Gavel?
Well, in 2005, I originally wrote God Versus the Gavel, Religion and the Rule of Law, because I saw the fact that religious entities were demanding rights they had never had before. But they were doing it under cover of a claim that somehow this had always been the regime, that they had always had these super rights. And the result of these demands was putting very vulnerable communities at risk. And I felt that people just, Americans, if they understood what was going on, that we could change the culture. It was literally taboo for me to write the book. Because what I did is I laid out all of the ways in which religious believers can harm people. Not that they don't do wonderful things for society and people, they do. But I had collected in a file that originally was labeled Religion Misbehaving, it turned into multiple individual files on prisons and land use and children and women and marriage. Once I had all those files together, it became clear to me that I just needed to lay out the case. You know, a law professor recently referred to that book as revolutionary in its candor. My view was, let's just put the facts on the table. So that's where I started.
That's an excellent starting point. And we said that the book is very topical today because of a particular case, which I think has already been argued. I don't follow, people call it SCOTUS, and that always drives me crazy. The Supreme Court. Can we just call it that?
Sure.
Yeah, SCOTUS. I don't think it – what does that mean? It sounds like something – I don't even want to tell you what that sounds like. But anyway, Anyway, the case is Sebelius versus Hobby Lobby. Hobby Lobby, a place that I take my kids sometimes to buy hobby stuff. Can you tell us a little bit about that case and what the arguments were? And I think the – I think it's supposed to be – I don't know when the – The decision, is that what you call it?
It's supposed to come out. Right. Well, the decision by Supreme Court rule, the Hobby Lobby decision, must be rendered by the last day in June.
Uh-huh.
It will be rendered within a month.
Okay, so tell us about the case.
This is a case where the evangelical Christian owners of Hobby Lobby, which is a company that has annual revenues of $3.3 billion, about 23,000 employees, and over 600 stores at this point and still growing. So this is a huge for-profit company that sells craft items. And they decided when the Affordable Care Act was passed, and it included a requirement of all reproductive health care for women, that they didn't want to cover, because of their religious beliefs, certain contraceptions. And their theory is that some contraceptives, they say, cause abortion. Now, you know, in fact, the medical science says it's not true, but they say it's true. And so they want to not fund, as part of the health care plan that they provide their many employees, this type of women's medical care. So what they did is, since they lost in Congress and they lost with the president, they then went to this very extreme statute, which is one of the main elements of God versus the Gavel. It's the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA. And they invoked RFRA, which provides for extreme religious liberty rights. They say that they have religious liberty rights to choose their health care plan for their employees according to their religious beliefs.
Yeah. Okay, I'm speechless.
Right. It was novel. It was shocking to me. Now, I've been working on these issues. I actually took RFRA to the Supreme Court, and in 1997, the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. It was reenacted after that. So I've been tracking this statute from the beginning in 1993 when it was first enacted, and even I was shocked that anyone would ever make this claim, but here we are.
Yeah. So let's kind of go back. You know, I'm a Lutheran. I was raised a Lutheran. So let's go back to the text.
Right.
Lutherans
right.
like that. What does the Constitution say about religious liberty? And I'll just give my opinion on that. As far as I know, it's the Establishment Clause, and that's it.
Well, it's the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause.
Okay. So
and
explain what those are.
Well, the Free Exercise Clause essentially says that government will not interfere with religion, but it doesn't say that there's an absolute right. The Establishment Clause says that the government won't establish religion. It won't back religion, essentially. But the beauty of our Free Exercise Clause, at least until RFRA appeared in 1993, was that it was routinely understood to be a right to liberty, but not a right to licentiousness. Mm-hmm. The framers' generation understood you can have too much liberty, and they called too much liberty licentiousness. Mm-hmm. I just call it extreme. Mm-hmm. And until we had this extreme right that gives the believer the right to trump laws in ways never before permitted before 1993, until then, basically the rule was, if there is a law that everybody else has to obey, just because you're religious doesn't mean that you don't have to obey it. So you don't get to abuse children like, you know, if nobody else can. You don't get to break the speeding laws. You have to abide by the land use laws. I mean, it was an ordered society, but government could not persecute religion. Government could not discriminate against any religion or target religion. And belief is absolutely protected. One of the revolutionary parts of our Constitution is that our beliefs are protected. The government can't tell us what to believe. So we had a very good working system. In 1993, religious groups won by deceiving Congress with a standard that did not restore the prior standard. It's a new standard, and that's what Hobby Lobby is using to try to get a second bite of the public policy apple.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Can we, I shouldn't say I'm sorry. Can we name names here a little bit? And you say religious groups. Who did that? I don't think the Lutheran Church did. Not, maybe they did. I don't know.
Here is the, and by the way, I'm Presbyterian. I'm married to a Catholic.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, we're Americans.
So well, you know, Lutherans, yep. You know, Lutherans about as controversial as they get is, you know, raising the price for items at their bake sales. I mean, that's pretty much it. I don't think they do anything bad. So go ahead.
So, well, here is the fascinating part of this history. When in 1990, when I was clerking at the Supreme Court, they decided the Smith decision. This is a peyote decision in which the Supreme Court said that two drug counselors who used illegal drugs and were fired for violating the law, because after all, they were drug counselors, did not have a First Amendment right to get unemployment compensation.
Yeah, as a taxpayer, I'm sort of hurt that we paid any money to decide that at all. But go ahead.
So, to be perfectly frank, at the Supreme Court, as a clerk, none of us thought this case amounted to a hill of beans.
Yeah.
Which basically tells you what clerks know. But at the end of the term, the religious groups, when this decision came down, talked to academics, some in particular, particularly Douglas Laycock and Michael McConnell and others, and essentially they decided that this was a political moment of great opportunity. And so they went on the attack, and they drafted a statute which they called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Yeah. And they concocted a standard that had never been applied before, and they went to Congress and they said, the Supreme Court just abandoned religious liberty. We want you to restore religious liberty. In other words, Congress, would you mind overruling the Supreme Court, which is obviously unconstitutional? Mm-hmm. But they told them that this has been the standard. And what happens? Congress buys it. They buy into this concept of, oh, wow, we can be the saviors of religious liberty. They don't investigate it. And dozens of religious groups fall in line. Mm. But what's most amazing is the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, falls in line. Mm. Americans United for Separation of Church and State falls in line. It was like there was a mass narcotic applied, and nobody looked at the cases to see, is this really what the Supreme Court had done in this case?
They were all doing peyote, maybe.
You know what? It is one of the anomalies, and we'll give social scientists and political scientists full careers, in my view. But the notion that it was sold as a restoration of the prior law, but in fact was an extreme standard, is truly remarkable. And so, yes, the Lutherans were in the group, the Presbyterians were in the group. And one of the we were talking about, is this a calling for me? Well, one of the wake-up moments for me was when I was litigating the Bernie case involving RFRA, and all of the amicus briefs landed on my front step on one day. And these are the briefs that are filed by outside groups informing the court of their views. And all the groups that would be in opposition, this was the day they would arrive. And I go, and there's this pile, and I had a baby and a little guy, and so I set them aside. And that night I go upstairs and I open them. It's every major religious group in the country.
Amazing.
Against me.
Sort of baby
and I
switch,
realize,
is what it was,
this is an interesting place to be for a good girl from Wheaton, Illinois.
Right.
But the truth is they all fell in line. They weren't thinking straight. And there was kind of a mass hypnosis that all religious liberty is good. And it took basically me writing God versus Gavel and saying it's time to talk about it because it's taboo. In the academic halls, you weren't allowed to say negative things about religion. You certainly weren't with religious groups. I wrote an editorial for Christianity Today in which I referred to religious lobbyists, and I was taken to task for that term, which, of course, I then started using daily. But the point was that here we had a situation where everybody who lined up didn't understand they were undermining their own interests. The real error was made by Congress. The members of Congress who worked very hard to pass laws didn't even blink an eye when there was a law in front of them that was going to undermine every single law in the country. And they didn't ask any hard questions. Mm-hmm. They all jumped on board. Oh, what a great idea. And so we ended up with RFRA. Now, since then, the ACLU, Americans United, People for the American Way, and a number of the Unitarian Church, a number of groups have peeled off because they've figured out that extreme religious liberty is oppression. The groups that we have still standing today and the groups that are pushing for the Hobby Lobby perspective are on essentially the fringes of religious belief, but they are very powerful. And so we've got the Alliance Defending Freedom, the Christian Legal Society, the Beckett Fund, and others. And so largely Catholic and evangelical fundamentalist Christian groups.
Mm-hmm. That's a remarkable story. I did not know that. You should write like a New Yorker piece about that or something, or an Atlantic piece. It's a good story.
Thank you. It is.
Because, I mean, you know, I mean, these people are just like, you know, it's the blind leading the blind after a moment. I mean, they're just doing stuff and not knowing what they're doing.
Well, it was. And when RFRA was held unconstitutional and a new bill was introduced to reintroduce it, I started calling groups that summer. My husband called me Paul Revere-ette of the summer. And I was just trying to explain to people that this is a really bad law for your interests.
Yeah.
I had groups like the National Organization of Women hang up on me.
Oh, boy.
Like, you know, who is this lunatic woman calling me and telling me that religious liberty is bad?
Right. Right. Well, no, you know, as somebody who, I guess I'm religious and I have a spiritual program or whatever you call it. If you want to help, what was the word again? Revive? Is that what they called it?
Restore.
Restore. If you want to restore religion, you should probably try to get people to go to church.
Right. Exactly.
You know, that seems like a more direct way to do it than going to the Supreme Court, because that's not going to get anyone to church. So anyway, one of the things that surprises me about this, and it's fascinating history, is that there is at least one and maybe two very famous cases in American history that almost everybody who's graduated from high school knows about, where religious liberty has come up against the requirements of the state and state law. And I'm thinking particularly of Quakers during World War II is what I know about, where according to their – this is not only Quakers but also Mennonites and some other people who just basically have a pacifistic religion. They could not fight. And then, you know, this issue must have come up.
Yes. Oh, it had come up repeatedly.
Yeah. And did you talk a little bit about how it's come up repeatedly? Yeah.
Well, for the conscientious objectors, the government applied the rule that is the rule that's been applied across the board, which is that the government has the power to create exceptions for religious believers. So you can create an exception for pacifists in the federal statutes, and that doesn't violate the Constitution, right? I mean, one of the questions is whether or not you can voluntarily accommodate religion, and that's something the government has permitted. Those conscientious objection cases came up in part because groups objected that they weren't covered by the current exemption. And eventually the court said, look, if you have a belief that occupies a place in your life that's like what ordinary religious believers have,
yeah,
you're covered as well. But, you know, the important thing about the conscientious objection cases, in my view, in the big picture, is that they weren't let out of public service. They were let out of the conducting the war.
Yeah.
And so it was not an absolute exemption. There wasn't a constitutional right to an absolute exemption, and there never has been. You know, from the beginning, we've had these exemptions for pacifists, but they've still been required to serve the country during time of war. And that's the kind of rational, common sense religious liberty that we've had for over 200 years. And it's the opposite, in my view, of what we're now living with.
Mm-hmm. And what about cases where I'm thinking about observing the Sabbath as a sort of Friday and Saturday for Jews and then Sunday for Christians. And I don't know what other groups do, but, you know, say you're a federal employee and you're asked to work on one of those days. What has been the law or the rule about that?
The rule is that if the government has an exception that permits you to take off time, and you can take it off for secular reasons, you have to be permitted to take it off for religious reasons as well.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a neutral rule that applies to everybody and nobody gets to take particular time off, say you work for a nuclear facility and it's part of your job that you simply have to be there at certain times, you don't get a religious exemption.
Mm-hmm.
So the rule is, under the court's standard, not under Congress's, but the court's standard, the rule is that if a law is neutral, it is not discriminatory, and it's generally applicable. And very simply what that means is it applies the same to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've got a neutral, generally applicable law, it's constitutional, even if it burdens your religion.
Mm-hmm.
The key here is not whether or not you happen to have a burden on religion. The question is whether or not the law is targeting religion or discriminating against it.
Mm-hmm. I see. And so another instance that just comes to me is that, again, this is with, I think Mennonites and, well, I'm not sure exactly, but it should be for all Christians because it's in the Sermon on the Mount, swearing oaths. Not supposed to do it as a Christian. Jesus said so.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, it's very interesting the way the courts divided up these issues. There is the absolute right to believe. There is a very high level of religious speech and the right not to speak.
I see.
And then there is the right of conduct. Uh-huh. So those cases involving oaths are the very highly protected right to speech. You have a right not to declare an oath mm-hmm. to God or whatever. So, for example, when you're sworn in court, you can choose to swear on the Bible or not.
Mm-hmm.
So the government can't force you to profess a faith. Can the government tell you, however, that when you walk into a courtroom, that you have to go through a metal detector? Yes, of course. Can they tell you that you can't wear a hat in their courtroom? Yes, they can tell you that. So the rule is neutral, generally applicable laws are fine, applied evenly to everybody. It's really fundamentally all about fairness. But at the same time, if the government wants to create an accommodation for a practice, mm-hmm. then it can. So actually, one of the biggest ironies of this whole story is that while they're demanding, all these groups are demanding through the Coalition for the Free Exercise of Religion that Congress pass a law to give them true religious liberty. Let's go back to the Smith case. So the court said there's no constitutional right to use peyote, even if it's in a religious service, in the state of Oregon. Following that case, every state where there is a meaningful number of Native American church members who use peyote passed an exemption. The federal government has an exemption.
Mm-hmm.
So they were arguing that they would never get religious liberty from legislatures.
Mm-hmm.
While they're arguing that, the very group that was the case that triggered all of this, that group was getting all the religious liberty it needed.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. the system works.
Yeah.
The system fundamentally works.
Yeah, I mean, that's a nice workaround. I mean, everybody can go to sleep at night thinking I did the right thing.
Right.
You're not asking anybody to like do anything ridiculous. Yeah.
And why would you want a court to decide, excuse me, I'm losing my voice. Why would you want a court to decide whether or not people can use peyote?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't.
Courts
like
don't know.
No, I wouldn't.
Figure it out.
Yeah, I wouldn't like that at all. No, I wouldn't like that at all. So, then, in light of this history, in light of these various accommodations that have been made for people of various religions, that is both legislative and otherwise, can you explain, I guess I'm asking you to do something you may have already done, and that is explain exactly how RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, what it asks us to do that we haven't done before.
Okay, so, and here's one of the reasons that RFRA has not bubbled to the surface of the public mind until recently, because it's a bunch of legal mumbo-jumbo. So, essentially...
I can't believe you said that.
Well, it is. It is. So, essentially, before we had... here, I'm going to take a sip of water.
Yeah,
and see
go
if
ahead.
I can.
Sure.
Okay. So before RFRA, the rule was that if you had a neutral, generally applicable law that applied to everybody, it was subjected to very low-level scrutiny. The court was very deferential to legislatures. If you had a law that discriminated against religion, in that case, it was bumped up to strict scrutiny. And everybody don't go to sleep now, but because this is the most critical part, sadly. What the court used to do for those kinds of laws where you had discrimination, they would say, we're not deferring to the government anymore. Government, you better show us a compelling interest and that the government and that the law you passed fits the ends that you say are the compelling interests. So there had to be a compelling interest in what's called narrow tailoring. And, you know, so it was a good system. If the government really was acting neutrally, the court did not spend a lot of time concerned about persecution. But if it looked like it was discriminating, you worry about it.
Yeah. Can you give us an example of that, of one that rises to the standard of strict scrutiny in the religious sort of legislative realm?
Yeah. So the one case where this has been applied was the case in 1993 involving Church of Lukumi Babalu IA.
I'm sorry. I'm sure those people are very serious. Go ahead.
Well, they're the Santerians,
which
is a combination of a kind of Catholic tradition, but also of a Caribbean religion.
Okay, good.
One of the things they do during their ceremonies is, out of deep religious belief, is they sacrifice animals.
Okay.
And they had moved into Hialeah, Florida, and frankly, Hialeah wanted to get rid of them. I mean, that's basically. So they passed a law. The city council passed an ordinance in which they said that sacrifice was illegal. But at the same time, they did not outlaw other ways of slaughtering animals. So the only people getting in trouble for slaughtering an animal were the ones who were doing it sacrificially.
Mm-hmm.
But, for example, kosher butchers were still okay.
Yeah, that was kosher.
Right,
sorry,
right.
Sorry.
So the court said, look, this is not a generally applicable law. You have passed a law that's really works in a way that only affects these religious believers. Now we're going to apply strict scrutiny. Now, here's a really important part of this whole story. In that case, the lawyer for the Church of Lukumi argued, and it was Doug Laycock, argued that the court should apply super strict scrutiny. The court should demand a compelling interest from the government, and it should be the least restrictive means possible for this group. In other words, every law had to be tailored to this religious believer.
Wow.
The court rejected that standard. They used their old standard. They used the standard they'd always used. And so that was 1993. The court rejects that standard. 5 months later, Congress passes RFRA with the rejected standard.
Huh.
So the Supreme Court explained yet again they weren't adopting this crazy standard. And 5 months later, Congress passes it with all of this rigmarole about, including President Clinton, about how wonderful RFRA is because it restores the standard that had always been in place. But RFRA creates a universe where not just the discriminatory laws, but every law is now subjected to the compelling interest test on the government and a least restrictive means requirement.
Uh-huh.
So it is a radical change. But it is portrayed as we are restoring the true religious liberty of the United States.
Right. So to go back to that 1993 case, if the locality would have passed a law that said, okay, no butchering of animals anywhere where our writ runs.
Yes.
By anybody, then the Supreme Court would have said, yeah, sure, fine.
Exactly. Exactly. And I actually got a call from animal rights groups the day the case came down. You know, they were upset about the permitting the practice by anybody. And I said, look, your problem is that it's got to be applied across the board. So for PETA to win, as an example of one of those groups, against that religious practice, you've got to persuade governments that they've got to outlaw kosher butchering too.
Right.
It's got to be neutral. If the government's going to selectively apply it, the government is going to be under a very heavy burden.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I see. Yeah, super strict. What did you call it? Super strict scrutiny.
Super strict scrutiny.
Yeah, it sounds like double secret probation from Animal House or something. So, how does? So thank you for explaining that. And so can you talk? Just go back to the Sebelius versus Hobby Lobby case. What are the Hobby Lobby people arguing, and on what grounds?
They are arguing that if they permit four types of contraception, which, by the way, are the types that are provided when a woman is raped, that those four types of contraception should not be covered by their health care plans that are mandated now by Obamacare, because if that's there, they will be complicit in a woman's decision to use it. So they're arguing that it's there's complicity, which is a real stretch. So the threshold question in all of these cases, in all free exercise cases, is does this law impose a substantial burden on the religious believer? Not a de minimis burden. There must be a substantial burden. And so their first hurdle for Hobby Lobby is they've got to show that including a medical treatment in a healthcare plan, which will then be used by an employee or not, and which you'll never know about because of the federal privacy laws, that substantially burdens their religious beliefs. But the other thing, and this is why this is such a shocking case, is they're claiming that they are this huge, they're the 135th company in terms of success on the Forbes list. Mm-hmm. They're claiming that their owners' religious beliefs can determine their corporate practices. And so it's as though there is no corporation. It's just the owners can use religion. And they're saying Hobby Lobby is religious, that this $3.3 billion industry is religious. And so that is the issue that the court is going to have to grapple with the most. Do you extend RFRA, as extreme as it already is, do you now extend it to for-profit corporations?
Again, I'm kind of speechless about this. Because, you know, as somebody who's not in the law, this degree of technicality about what are really sort of simple ethical issues is just remarkable.
Exactly. I mean, in the end, how about just some common sense?
Yeah, well, you know, the thing about it is
to have common sense.
Yeah, the people who at Hobby Lobby, who I'm sure I would like very much and I have great sympathy for, I'm sure that they're complicit in all kinds of things as Christians that they don't want to be complicit in. I mean, every Christian is. I mean, that's the deal about being a Christian.
The two best parts of this case are that Hobby Lobby was funding this type of medical care in their health care plan until it became mandatory. And so they opted. So they
changed. It's kind of disingenuous at that point, then, isn't it? Is there an argument to sort of disingenuousness? I mean, you know, you're not really.
Well, if that didn't show a lack of sincerity, yeah. It turns out that their investment funds are heavily into the companies that make emergency contraception.
Yeah, uh-huh, right. Well, as I say, there's the complicity when you live in a society that has many dependencies as ours, and that's a zillion dependencies. I mean, you can never act completely completely in line with your religious beliefs. That's just simply impossible, and that's not the required standard. That's why we have forgiveness. So then what is the government arguing then? The government is saying...
The government is correctly arguing, in my view, that Title VII does not permit religious... employee. It does not permit secular for-profit companies to discriminate on the basis of religion or gender. And so what the government has to show is that it has a compelling interest in requiring that contraception be a part of healthcare plans. And I think they should win that hands down. Uh-huh. The science is clear that the cost of healthcare goes down dramatically when you provide a full range of contraception to women. And so I think that they're in pretty good shape on proving a compelling interest. They're arguing that Hobby Lobby is not the type of entity that can raise a RFRA claim, that there really is no substantial burden. But here's the kicker. If the government loses on substantial burden and they lose on and even if they win on showing that there's a compelling interest in providing women full reproductive health care, then the government has to show that this is the least restrictive means for Hobby Lobby. And so there are all sorts of arguments about what is the least restrictive means. And wouldn't you know it, oral argument, that the lawyer for Hobby Lobby suggested that it would be less restrictive on Hobby Lobby if the government would just pay for that medical care.
I love these guys. I really do. I love these guys. They give lawyers a great name.
Agreed.
I love these guys. So, yeah, how do I hire them? That's what I want to know. So I guess you've convinced me that this doesn't make a lot of sense. That's not legal, but it doesn't make a lot of sense. But what would be a RFRA claim could you imagine a case in which an employer or somebody said under RFRA, this really does impinge upon my religious liberty. I do need an exception.
Well, not for-profit employers, but I certainly any time that you have a law that is discriminating against or targeting a religious group, I think it's exactly the right thing for the courts to get to make it very difficult for the government. But the truth is that whenever you have a circumstance like that, the First Amendment's standard, which is the one the court used to invalidate the city of Hialeah's sacrifice law, it's already there. The First Amendment already protects what's needed. RFRA is a sui generis addition. It's just not necessary, and it causes more harm than it helps. And here's the other part of it. The RFRA has an attorney's fees provision and this causes many claims to go forward and to be settled that should not be. So the religious believer demands, this is what I want, and the government then is threatened with having to pay its own lawyers, but also having to pay the lawyers for the other side. So if someone wins with this extreme religious liberty right, then the government has to pay everybody's fees. So it's a regime which is not only religion friendly, but it's religion preferential. It gives them a standard they never had before, and attorney's fees.
That's a sweet deal.
Yeah, it is.
How do I get that?
It just invites litigation.
Yeah. So you talk in the book about this is also very topical, obviously, same-sex marriage, and then an issue which I think is related to it, and that is polygamy, and even things like I got to imagine it's coming sibling marriage and things like this. Could you talk a little bit about that in the context of the interaction between religion and the federal law?
Sure. Well, what's happened is that when in the Bernie case, when the court declared the federal RFRA unconstitutional, the conservative religious groups fanned out to the 50 states, and they persuaded some of the states to pass their own state RFRAs. And so we now have about half the states with this the state RFRAs under their own standard. So, you know, now it is possible to apply this extreme religious liberty to state law as well. And so if you have a state where you have a state RFRA, and you have someone who is engaging in child abuse or polygamy or underage marriage, they can now raise this RFRA as a defense. And it's raised all the time. The RFRA argument is raised in clergy sex abuse cases routinely for religious groups to avoid liability.
That's interesting. So could you tell us anything about some of those cases? I don't know. I haven't read about any of them. Well, let me just give an example, sort of hypothetical. If I I have one wife. If I decided in a fit of insanity I wanted another, and I had two wives, the state of Massachusetts said, well, we can't do that. And I said, well, no, it's part of my religion.
Exactly. Well, in most states and routinely, the religious right to marry multiple spouses has been rejected.
I see.
Over history. We haven't seen these cases work out because we really don't have religious polygamy groups in every state that are active right now. But we do have the Cody Brown case. And the Cody Brown case is, of course, this is the sister wives, as disgusting as that title is, the sister wives reality show, and represented by Jonathan Turley, they argued for a religious right to have multiple wives in Utah.
Levite marriage, yeah.
And they won. And so that case is still pending. It's being appealed by the state of Utah, but the essentially, you know, they're making a lot of different arguments, but the main argument is that if this is their religious belief, they should be left alone, and where's the harm?
Mm-hmm.
And the critical part of that case is that the state of Utah did a terrible job in proving the harm, so that it's not just RFRA that's a problem. Our whole culture is doused with deference to religious bad behavior, mm-hmm. and it's for political reasons. And in the state of Utah, at the highest levels, they have turned a blind eye to bad behavior by polygamous groups for decades. And in this case, they're litigating, defending their state law banning polygamy. They didn't even put in the evidence of how harmful polygamy is inherently to women and children.
Hmm. That's amazing. So talk a little bit about same-sex couples and same-sex marriage and how that relates to religious freedom in the federal law.
Well, this has been it's been a gift that these issues have bubbled up at exactly at the same time the Supreme Court is considering whether to expand RFRA to corporations. Right now, we have one state, Mississippi, has passed a state RFRA, which is intended to be applied so that businesses can refuse to offer service to same-sex couples. Homosexuals. A similar bill was introduced in Arizona several months ago, but it was even more extreme. The bill in Arizona would have permitted discrimination by religious believers on any ground, gender, race, sexual orientation, etc. And that bill was so extreme that the Chamber of Commerce came out against it. The NFL, Major League Baseball, you know, how do you end up in a universe where you have the NFL needing to comment on religious liberty?
Yeah, that is weird.
It's because we have reached the shoals of extremism and fanaticism. And in that case, in Arizona, essentially, Jan Brewer, the governor, was put under tremendous pressure to veto it, and she finally did.
Uh-huh.
But it's not because the Alliance Defending Freedom and the conservative groups in opposition to homosexuals didn't lobby heavily. They expended tremendous resources. But what we learned there is something that I think was good for the whole country to see, which is that there is a limit.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be a limit. And the view that if you're a business owner, you can turn someone away at the door because of their sexual orientation is, first of all, it's morally disgusting. But at the same time, it's just back to the Jim Crow laws. And the way the Arizona law was set up, we have plenty of race-based religions in the United States. The Southern Poverty Law Center tracks all of them,
mm-hmm.
and there are plenty in Arizona. So it wouldn't have been limited to sexual orientation, as bad as that is. You could have had bakeries that when a black person walked in said, hey, we don't serve blacks.
Mm-hmm.
So these are scary times. And I think one of the things I think that people forget is that discrimination and slavery in the South were based on religion.
Mm-hmm.
It was deeply religious. And so if we open the door to religious-based discrimination, it's going to take us back to some very, very bad times in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Just to generalize a little bit, are there any cases? So again, I'm a layman, and I know that there's this thing, a place of public accommodation, right? That's
mm-hmm.
a legal term. You got to serve anybody pretty much. And then
yeah.
there's also a kind of parallel thing in the employment world. You can't just fire somebody because they are, you know, have this characteristic they can do nothing about, right?
Right.
Right.
But,
okay. So I guess my question is, are there any exceptions to those rules? Is there any place of public accommodation where somebody says, well, I just can't serve people like this because it's against my religion. I just can't do it.
Not really. Now, under the federal anti-discrimination laws, you have to have a business that has over a certain number of employees. So, you know, so the tiny businesses are not affected by the federal anti-discrimination laws. But the state anti-discrimination laws tend to apply to everybody. And as they should. The reason that our free market works so well is that we judge products based on the product, right? And one of the things that I think is so troubling about this entire universe is that I now have to know, for example, that Chick-fil-A, their owner, is anti-gay.
Yeah.
You know, I really liked Chick-fil-A. And now every time I pass it, I won't go in. I didn't want to know that Hobby Lobby discriminates against their female employees because, frankly, sometimes AC Moore doesn't have everything I want.
Yeah, Hobby Lobby's okay, actually. I take my kids there, like I said.
Yeah. I mean, this is a problem. If you start freighting your economy with religious identity, you start dividing the entire country, we will become balkanized. And so the motivation, really, for God versus the gavel this time around is because I have a sincere and deep fear that we are moving toward religious division like we've never seen it before. And I would really like to see the courts and the legislatures pull this back to common sense and let us go back to being Americans and not have to wear our religion on our sleeves in every aspect of our lives.
So I understand the business about public accommodation. Are there any cases in employment law where somebody says, okay, I have this employee, but they've started to practice this religion, and even though it does not interfere at all with the performance of their job, they cannot work here?
Those employees are protected.
Yeah, okay.
Those employees are protected. And actually, that's one of the issues with Hobby Lobby, is those female employees cannot be discriminated based on religion.
Mm-hmm.
So if their religion permits them to use emergency contraception, that healthcare plan is actually discriminating against them.
Yeah, yeah, I see what you mean. Now, there are some other cases of discrimination, not necessarily religiously based, that I think people would find fascinating. And I don't know whether to call it discrimination or not, because it's not like other folks are beating down the door. I'm here at Smith College. It's a women's college.
Yeah.
They don't have men here. Well, they do have men here. I'm here. But they don't admit men, I don't think. What does the law say about that now?
Well, the law has permitted that and that's really kind of equal protection.
Uh-huh.
And the court has given more latitude for, you know, discriminating between the genders. And not necessarily discriminating against. And if there's a strong reason for keeping an organization as single gender, the courts have been more willing to permit it. But also, Smith is a private school.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
You know, so there's a difference between what the private schools and the public schools can do. The public schools, for example, the Virginia Military Institute, was not permitted to remain same gender. They had to open it to women. And so the real point is that there are private entities and there are public entities in terms of education.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're looking for interesting cases involving those who discriminate, you know, the prisons are filled with prisoners who are believers in either extreme Islamicism and extreme terrorist positions, or are white supremacists. Mm-hmm. The white supremacists run through all the prisons. And one of the things that RFRA does, and its statute that now applies to the state prisons, which is the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, our LUPA. If you've got RFRA and our LUPA in place, the prisons now have to prove that they have a compelling interest and they are using the least restrictive means when they use security practices against white supremacist gangs.
Wow.
And that's a burden they shouldn't have to bear, and they never had to bear that burden before the RFRA came into place.
Wow. That is not where I don't want a lot of my tax dollars spent on that. sorry.
Prisoners have a lot of time to think up a lot of interesting both religions and practices There's a lot of litigation, and it is the taxpayers that are footing it.
Mm-hmm. Now, so then, how does RFRA go away?
Well, the only way for RFRA to go away, well, there are two ways. One, and I filed an amicus brief for a number of groups in the Hobby Lobby case arguing it's unconstitutional. It was unconstitutional in 1997 when I won on behalf of Bernie, Texas, the case. It's still unconstitutional, and the court should address that. But the issue's not being raised. So the only thing it would be for Congress to repeal it. And frankly, I suppose there must be some concern that Hobby Lobby may well not come out the way that they want it to, because Orrin Hatch, the senator from Utah, who sponsored, along with Ted Kennedy, the original RFRA, has now come out.
Ted
this week.
Kennedy?
Oh,
holy
yes.
Holy cow.
Ted Kennedy and Orrin Hatch ever are religious. They couldn't serve.
Any piece of legislation that is sponsored by two guys like that.
Right, right.
You know, it's not going in the right direction.
Exactly. Well, and signed by Bill Clinton. Those three would do anything for religion. It's mindless on these issues. And by the way, the biggest fan of RFRA in the Clinton administration was our current Justice Kagan.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So we have all of this pro-religion in Washington. But Hatch this week announced that if Hobby Lobby goes the so-called wrong way, he will then propose a constitutional amendment. Mm-hmm. So right now, RFRA could be repealed. If the RFRA standard became a constitutional standard, that would be the end of the ballgame.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's when I would move to, say,
right.
The Caribbean.
So Kagan supports – Kagan likes RFRA?
Kagan is in favor of extreme religious liberty. In the case that permitted discrimination by religious groups against their own clergy, she wrote – there were only two of them that said this, but she and Justice Alito said that religious groups should have autonomy from the law.
Wow.
Autonomy. Very scary.
Yeah. Well, she's an academic, you know.
I can't trust them. And frankly, this whole RFRA movement has been fueled by academics who didn't do their homework and have hidden the ball all the way down the line.
Yeah, I see that. Well, it's kind of scary, actually, now that I'm really glad we talked to you, because I wasn't really aware of the importance of these things. And as, again, someone who, I am religious myself, but just the thing that I come away with is, why aren't all these deeply religious people concentrating on their religion? And not messing around with this stuff.
I completely agree. And, one of my heroes in the United States is John DiIulio, who's a professor at Penn, who has really worked hard to try to find a middle ground. And what he's really trying to find is a way for people to help people through religion. That's what we should be doing. And really, the reason I'm in this game or in this maelstrom where I've got bishops calling me names, and it's not a comfortable place to be, but it's because all the vulnerable that are being hurt, it's the children and the women, it's the disabled, all of them are being now hurt by religious liberty, and I really would like to see us go back to common sense, and let's see religion turn back toward its true ministry, which is, service to the poor.
Yeah. Well, like I say, it's not complicated. I mentioned the Sermon on the Mount. You just have to read the Sermon on the Mount, and it's cowboy simple. It says love your enemies. It says love sinners. It says if somebody asks for your shirt, give them your coat. It says, this is not complicated stuff. So the people who work for Hobby Lobby who are going to use this contraception, if those people feel like they're doing kind of the wrong thing, they shouldn't harass them. Of course, they should try to help them.
Precisely.
Help them through this.
Surely, they can certainly offer all sorts of services.
Yeah.
But I actually think the ugliest part and the nub of fully understanding what's going on here, and it's not just Hobby Lobby, it's Conestoga Woods and many other groups. The issue here is that this is contraception, that if a woman has been raped, primary way of not becoming pregnant from a rape.
Yeah.
Who is going to expend all of these millions of dollars on litigation and public policy, trying to keep those women from making their own choice, which is constitutionally protected. Yeah. What we are seeing here is the powers that be are roaring. They're grabbing a standard that they never had before. They're going for it. And as usual, who's going to lose? It's the women and the children. Yeah. That's just the way history works.
Yeah, it is sad, you know, I mean, because they become involved, you know, it's like a friend of mine says, well, not a friend of mine, I sometimes say this myself, would you rather be right or would you rather be happy? I'd rather be happy, thanks very much. And that involves, you know, kind of being kind to people, not telling them they're wrong and shoving it in their faces, you know, that sort of thing. So anyway, Marcia, this has been absolutely fantastic. We should just have you on again just to talk about the book after the decision comes out. That would be really fun.
I will be revising it, actually. Yeah. And so it's only out in e-version now. It will be out in paperback in the fall with a full discussion of Hobby Lobby.
I bet it will. So are you going to, like, do you get to go sit in or anything like that and sit in the gallery and listen as the
No, I will be. The beauty of this day and age is that the cases are released simultaneously. So the minute it comes down, I'll be reading it, and then I'll be writing about it and posting my views on my blog almost immediately.
I think you've inspired me. I'm going to write an amicus brief. Would they take pencil? Because I just have like a pencil here and a piece of paper. I'll just like send it off to them.
Oh, no. If you're not willing to spend about $1,000 to have your brief printed, you're out.
Okay, fine. That's discrimination against people who don't make any money like me. But that's all my fault that I don't make any money. I'm in the wrong business. I should be a lawyer for Hobby Lobby is what I should be.
Oh, there you go. Oh, truly.
So, Marcia Hamilton, it's been wonderful talking to you. We've been talking to Marcia Hamilton about God versus the Gavel, the perils of extreme religious liberty. Marcia, let me close the interview with our traditional final question on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now?
My next book is going to be an inside look at the culture wars, and it's similar. It's basically a memoir of battling every religious group in the country, and there have been some choice things both said and written about the work that I've been doing, and apparently I'm a bitter woman.
Sounds bitter to me.
I'm not. And actually, I think the world needs to see that the religious forces that I'm writing about in God versus the Gavel are really at base bullies.
Yeah.
And so I'm really writing an anti-bullying book about religion. Mm.
Well, that sounds really interesting. I hope you can come on the show when you are done with it.
Thank you.
All right, good enough. Let me tell everyone again for the third time, we've been talking with Marcia Hamilton about God versus the Gavel, the perils of religious liberty. Marcia, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And let me say to everyone who listens to the mini podcasts on the New Books Network with its 99 channels, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you have a great week.